By downloading or listening to this podcast, you are agreeing to Moody's legal terms and conditions found at moodys.com/disclaimer, including that the information provided is not investment or financial advice, and that Moody's will not be liable for losses arising from your use of the information.
I'm Danielle Reed, and this is Moody's Talks, Focus on Finance. In today's episode, I'll be talking with Sean Hung and Yulia Wan of the Financial Institutions team about policy shifts by China's government, which is grappling with economic disruption from COVID-19-related shutdowns, as well as fallout from the near default of one of the country's big four distressed asset managers last year, continued distress in the property sector, and disruptions from the ongoing Russia-Ukraine military conflict. So a lot going on there. And specifically, we'll be talking about steps China's government has taken to support the property sector and to restore confidence in China's capital markets, and what that shift in policy focus means for financial institutions. Later, my co-host Miles Nelligan will talk to Eugene Tarzimanov and Yaroslav Sovgira about the effects of inflation and inflation-related monetary policy changes on banks in the 10 emerging markets that are part of the G20 economies. Miles, thanks for joining.
Hi, Danielle. Always good to be here.
So inflation is making its way around the globe in developed and emerging markets alike. What are the highlights from your conversation with Yaroslav and Eugene? In other words, what kind of an impact from inflation and the monetary policy response to inflation will we see among the 10 emerging markets banking systems in the G20?
Well, Danielle, one important point is that inflation and the increase in interest rates that typically follows have complex effects for emerging market banks. There are a lot of factors at play. One is how indebted households are, and another is whether the economy is highly dollarized or not. Both of those affect the extent to which monetary policy responses are effectively transmitted to the wider economy. But leaving those subtleties aside, there are two main countervailing effects. Firstly, higher inflation and the typical monetary policy response of higher interest rates tend to widen banks' net interest margins.
Which is a good thing.
The net interest margin, or NIM, is the gap between the rate banks lend at and the rate they pay to their own depositors. And a higher NIM means higher profit. However, the second effect is that higher inflation and interest rates tend to slow an economy down and can also make it harder for some borrowers to keep up their repayments.
And that's a less good thing.
Very much so. Slower growth can deter consumers and businesses from borrowing, which means banks don't get the benefits of higher rates. And of course, if more borrowers default, the banks have to set aside more provisions against bad loans.
So I'm guessing moderate inflation is probably on balance not a bad thing for banks in many emerging markets, but rapidly accelerating inflation and the attendant rapid monetary policy response, that would be negative.
Yeah, that's about right. And of course, the particulars of any given scenario vary by country.
Miles, thank you. I look forward to you and Yaroslav and Eugene unpacking high inflation in emerging markets in just a few minutes. But first, I'm here with financial institutions team analysts Sean Hung in Hong Kong, SAR, and Yulia Wan in Shanghai to talk about the Chinese government's shift in policy focus and what it means for financial institutions. Sean and Yulia, welcome to Focus on Finance.
Hi, Daniel. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to be here, Daniel.
So today, as I mentioned a few moments ago, we're going to look at the steps China's government has taken to support the property sector and to restore confidence in China's capital markets, and what those policy shifts mean for financial institutions. Sean, let's start with you. The Chinese government is trying to stabilize the economy in a difficult environment on the one hand, and at the same time has been trying to remove moral hazards from the system. You know, by moral hazards, I mean discourage companies from taking on too much risk because they think somehow the government will bail them out. Can you talk a little bit about those two goals and how this applies to the bailout of Huarong AMC, one of China's big four state-owned asset managers? First of all, what happened with Huarong AMC and what is its special role in the Chinese economy?
Sure, Daniel. Huang AMC was set up in 1999 during the Asian financial crisis. It is one of the big four distressed asset management companies in China. Apart from its core business, the company has banking, security, asset management, and trust business. The company reported a net loss of around $60 billion in 2020, which basically pushed its capital level below the regulatory requirement and disrupted its business operations. We believe a failure of Huayong AMC could have some systematic implications. First, Huayong AMC was majority owned by the Ministry of Finance, so it is a state-owned financial institution. The failure of this company and the lack of government support would bring the reputational risk and contingent risk to other state-owned enterprises and the Chinese government. On the other hand, because of Huayong AMC's size and its special role in the Chinese economy, its failure would have immediate impact to different sectors, including the financial system.
So in this case, the government decided to intervene and orchestrate a bailout.
Yes, that's why the government eventually bailed out the company. However, instead of direct capital injection from the Ministry of Finance, the government asked five state-owned companies and financial institutions to inject a total of $6.5 billion new capital into Huayong AMC. In addition, the government has streamlined Huayong AMC's business model by disposing some of its financial subsidiaries and changed its board structure, which can allow the company to refocus on its core business. In this bailout, we can see that the Chinese government remained willing and able to step in to provide the support to the distressed companies if the default jeopardizes the economic and social stability. However, the government support will be selective and it is not unconditional.
Right. That sounds like an important point, and I'd like to hear more on that. But just one more question before we turn to how the government is going to decide whether or not to intervene to help companies, especially, you know, larger or state-owned companies in distress. And my question is, are the companies now being asked to bail out Huarong? Are they now at risk because of the capital they're injecting into Huarong?
Yeah, we believe the government will continue to encourage strong state-owned enterprises to support their distressed peers. This approach will add the credit burdens to them. Huayong AMC's capital injection was executed via the issuance of new shares with significant premium. While the bailout and the restructuring may help Huayong AMC turn around and eventually bring an investment gain to these strategic investors, the execution and the tail risk could create a burden on their balance sheet for some time. However, we believe the impact is still manageable, because this investment was shared by a few state-owned enterprises which have good financial position. So the credit burden will not significantly affect their overall credit profile.
Got it. Now, aside from the Huarong AMC situation last year, the other big crisis most investors around the world probably remember was China's property sector. A developer named Evergrande, among several other developers, ran into difficulties paying debts, and there were a number of defaults. Does the government provide any support for real estate developers?
First of all, property developers are different to Huayong AMC. We don't believe the Chinese government will provide direct support to the property developer, especially these companies are mostly privately owned companies. Their failure will not create any reputational risk and contingent risk to the Chinese government. However, real estate market is important to Chinese economy. It accounts for around 28% of the Chinese GDP. Losses and default in the property market can create problems for the creditors, financial institutions, and local governments. So the government has taken actions to stabilize the market. The central banks also provide market liquidity by cutting the interest rates, lowering the mortgage rate. The target is to maintain the economic and social stability.
So I understand that the property sector is very important to the economy, really important from what you just described, even though individual property developers don't have any systemic importance. What has the government asked state-owned enterprises to do in terms of the property sector to help stabilize it?
Recently, the government has encouraged state-owned enterprises to acquire the good assets from the property developers. The big four distressed asset management companies have been asked to participate in the restructuring of the real estate developers and provide them with the liquidity support. For example, Cinda AMC lead the working group on Evergrande Group's restructuring. Orient AMC and Great Wall AMC have issued a 10 billion yuan financial bond respectively on the onshore bond market to provide support to the restructuring of the property developer in China.
Thanks, Sean. And that's a good segue to bring in Yulia, who wrote a report on banks and property developers, specifically on how banks are adapting to guidance meant to help stabilize the property sector. Yulia, how has China's government's policy shifted regarding banks and the property sector? And how have banks reacted to that change in guidance?
Thanks, Daniel. Government policy guidance to support the property market and restore market confidence in the sector has become increasingly active in recent months. We expect banks to be selective in response to the policy shift by supporting mortgage lending, which will help market demand. Banks have relaxed mortgage lending criteria this year in response to local government policies, including easing down payment requirements and controls on mortgage loan approvals. They will also further lower mortgage lending rates with the latest regulatory guidance on lowering the minimum reference lending rate of commercial mortgage loans for first home purchase.
Okay, so a lot of that is going to help boost mortgages and mortgage finance. What about financing property developers?
We think banks will remain cautious about financing property developers via loans, bonds, and asset management products, given the sector's asset risks and slowing economic growth. Regulatory measures, such as guidelines to constrain property lending by different types of banks, and the three red line policy are still in effect, despite some marginal loosening. This will keep banks from growing their lending to property developers significantly. Property development loans accounted for 6.2% of Chinese financial institutions' gross loans at the end of March 2022, and we expect this figure will remain roughly stable this year because of banks' cautious approach to the sector.
But even if banks don't increase their exposure to the property sector too much, there's still asset risk from what banks do have on their balance sheets now, correct?
Yes, that's correct. Tight liquidity and weak sales will result in more property developers running into financial difficulties over the next 6 to 12 months. And NPL ratios from corporate loans to real estate sector will remain high. NPLs from corporate loans to real estate sector were the major source of new NPLs in 2021. Regional banks face higher credit risk than national banks in lending to property developers. Some regional banks have a disproportionately high share of corporate loans to real estate sector in comparison to their loss absorption capabilities and carry high NPL ratios. Regional banks' corporate governance and risk management practice are generally weaker than those of national banks, and they are more prone to lending to high-risk developers. In contrast, national banks have more diversified balance sheets and stronger loss absorption capabilities, mitigating the impact from property sector fallout.
Okay, so it sounds like there's going to be some potential trouble ahead. Almost certainly, but it's not going to be the same across different bank types. And last question, what about spillover effects to the banking sector from a property market downturn? Is that a concern at all?
Yes, that's right. On one side, Chinese banks have sufficient loss absorbing capability to deal with losses resulting from their direct exposure to the property market, as their direct exposure is not large. And banks' loans to developers are mostly secured by collateral. On the other side, banks would face spillover risks if the property market fallout continues and impacts economic growth, with, as Sean mentioned earlier, around 28% of China's GDP from property and related sectors along the supply chain. Some of the developers' trade payables could ultimately result in losses for banks. While distressed companies along the supply chain could add to banks' asset risks. Banks are also likely to share a large financial burden as authorities could call on those banks to support weak corporate borrowers and financial institutions. Regulators' supportive measures to mitigate the impact on economic growth caused by the property market fallout and the coronavirus lockdowns have been modest so far, which has led to the potential of below-target GDP growth and increasing asset risks for Chinese banks.
Yulia, thank you for that. So it sounds like there is some more potential risk, as I said, awaiting China's banks stemming from the property sector, although it's going to depend on what happens in terms of the downturn and its length and severity. And we're now joined by my co-host, Miles Nelligan, here to talk to Yaroslav Sovgira and Eugene Tarzimanov about emerging markets, banks, and inflation.
Thanks, Danielle, and a big welcome to Yaroslav and Eugene. Eugene, let's start with an overview. Your report covers the 10 emerging markets that are in the G20 group of economies. That's Brazil, Russia, India, Indonesia, Turkey, South Africa, China, Argentina, Saudi Arabia, and Mexico. Could you tell our listeners how banks in these countries typically respond to higher inflation and tighter monetary policy?
Well, as you said in the introduction, there are two main diverging effects on banks. One is that net interest margins tend to rise because inflation usually means higher interest rates by central banks because of the typical monetary policy response, which is to raise rates to fight inflation when it breaches a certain target. And higher interest rates mean banks can charge more for their loans, so more interest income for banks. Ultimately, higher profits for banks.
Okay, that sounds fairly straightforward. What's the second effect?
Well, the second effect could be negative, right? So that is that higher interest rates are designed to cool inflation and lead to decreased economic growth. So if there's a sharp rise in rates and as a result, a material increase in debt servicing costs for borrowers, this can lead to higher asset risk for the banks. So businesses and individuals in that scenario might have trouble servicing or refinancing their debt. This can lead to higher problem loans, meaning that banks would have to create additional loan loss provisions. So that would tend to have the opposite effect of higher net interest margins. In this case, it would lower the return on assets of banks.
Okay, and in what circumstances would one effect outweigh the other? In other words, when is inflation more of a negative than a positive?
Well, broadly speaking, and very broadly, when inflation accelerates or is especially steep, this is when negatives tend to outweigh positives in most of the emerging market banking systems we looked at.
Okay, that's interesting. Yaroslav, let's drill down to the next level of detail. Have the central banks in all 10 of the countries we're discussing raised their policy rates?
Not in all, but in most. You see, inflation and policy responses haven't been the same in all 10 economies. Turkey, for example, has been facing the steepest inflation, which hit 73% in May, and Argentina 61%. Still, now that central banks in most of these economies have raised policy rates, we expect inflation to abate in all 10 economies next year, which would help to contain asset risks for banks.
And is there anywhere where you would expect to see an increase in banks' net interest margins?
Well, we expect that banks in India, Saudi Arabia, and South Africa will post larger increases in margins this year and next year. Margin improvements will be driven by higher policy rates and the bank's favorable deposit structures, which take more time to reprice up compared to the repricing of loans. You see, there's always a delay from when policy rates increase to when you see the effect on net interest margins. because it takes banks a while to reset their rates.
And what about the other seven countries?
The margins in most other countries will improve, but not that materially. In some markets, margins might not improve at all, for example, in China and Argentina. The authorities in China will likely maintain a mildly accommodative monetary policy, while in Argentina, any margin benefits for banks will be limited by regulations on interest rates.
And what about the impact on problem loans? Eugene, where, if anywhere, would you worry about rising asset risk, particularly if inflation comes in higher than expected or stays high for longer than expected?
For this year and next, we expect that banks in Russia and Turkey will post larger increases in credit costs and NPLs because of macroeconomic challenges, including inflation and swings in currencies. If inflation accelerates further, credit costs will also rise in Argentina.
You know, I think your report has a chart that shows the correlation of inflation and banks' bottom line profitability as measured by return on assets. Which countries show a decline in return on assets given a rise in inflation?
Yeah, Danielle, we've looked at 15 years of data and looked at how inflation over that period correlates with bank profitability. And we have identified four countries, South Africa, Russia, Turkey, and Brazil, where changes in credit costs and inflation rates are more closely linked. And while gains in net interest margins are not significant because of their funding structure. And here we looked at the share of bank funding that is related to deposits that are less sensitive to interest rates, such as current and savings accounts. So the less of such deposits you have, the worse the effect on your margins, such as in those four systems that we have identified.
Got it. Thanks, Eugene and Yaroslav, Miles, Yulia, and Sean. Thank you all very much for your insights. And a big thank you to our listeners for tuning in. To read any of the research referenced in this episode, you can go to show notes for the episode at about.moodys.io/podcasts. And please tune in again soon for future episodes of Focus on Finance.
Thanks for listening to this Moody's Talks podcast. To find out more about the topics discussed, please follow the links in the show notes. You can check out other Moody's Talks podcasts by visiting moodys.com/podcasts.